friends. Welcome to the Book Exchange Podcast. This is episode 61, and it's an episode that's so big that we have made kind of a radical decision here. I've got my co-host, Jude Love, on the line, as always. Jude, we've made a radical decision. At the last second, when we were just starting to get ready to record, we decided to split this episode into two parts. So, friends, you should know that already from... If you're listening to this, you should see the title that this is indeed part one of a two-part episode 61. And the reason for that is the subject we're taking on is an absolutely monumental one, both in terms of like literal scope and also literary influence, I would say, or influence on the culture. We are going to be talking about Mr. Stephen King, one of this show's favorite writers, and in particular, one of your favorite writers, Jude. So I would imagine you're very excited to dive into this one.
Yeah. Greetings, John. I really am. You know, I feel like I could do many, many episodes on the man that I affectionately call Uncle Stevie because he refers to himself as Uncle Stevie a lot. And we'll get into him and his manner. But yeah, like I'm really excited. There's Stephen King is very influential on me personally and a lot of millions of readers, you know, in one way or another. So there's definitely enough. Like you alluded, we haven't done this before with a two-part episode. Maybe you said that, maybe you didn't. I don't remember, but we haven't. And so, but Uncle Steve is definitely worth a larger episode. So I can't wait.
No, this is something that we've been talking about, you know, since we started the show, you know, eventually getting here in terms of doing an episode on Stephen King. We teased it a little bit, in the weeks before this episode, then when we kind of got down to nuts and bolts, at least from my end, looking at the ways we wanted to approach it, because he's got this huge body of work, and you know, it's a pretty daunting task to say how do you dive into this topic, and just realize that rather than you know sweating it out and looking at our clocks and trying to see if we can fit in everything we want to say in one episode, we would stretch it to two, and I think the somewhat unique solution that we came up with to approach this topic is we're calling this episode, as again, as you've seen from the title, we're calling it Stephen King Then and Now. And so Stephen King has such a vast corpus of work, as just about everybody knows. And by the way, I should also say the reason we need at least two parts is you're talking about, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that Stephen King is the best-selling novelist of all time. You know, across the globe. I think maybe the Harry Potter series might be the best-selling books, but no single novelist, correct me if I'm wrong, dude, no single novelist has sold as many books or has been read as widely as Stephen King. So that's another reason why we felt, you know, this needed a little bit, we just needed to stretch this out a little bit more. And so with the then and now concept, what we decided to do as an entryway into the work of Stephen King in general is to take a look at a very, very early book and one of his most recent books and kind of compare and contrast those. And by way of doing that, I think we'll have a lot to say about the style of Stephen King, you know, types of books that he's written, how his style may or may not have changed, et cetera, et cetera. That's our approach, Stephen King then and now. So this episode, we're going to have some general discussion about Mr. King and his work. And I you know, I can hear over the microphones here, my co-host, he's like, I can hear him foaming at the mouth because he's got so much to say. That's good. Thanks for the sound effects. So we're going to have some general discussion, which is going to be a lot of fun. Then we're going to get into the then portion of this two-part podcast. We're going to talk about a very early book of his called The Long Walk that was published all the way back in 1979. Not his first book published, but one of the earliest things that he ever worked on, and we'll get into that. And then for part two, which we're going to try to put out relatively quickly, part two is we're going to focus on one of his brand new books, because he's always got a new book, both out and coming. One of the things that we'll talk about is just how dang prolific this guy is, but so we're going to talk about a book called Fairy Tale, which was just published in 2022. I don't think has even come out on paperback yet. I could be wrong. But it's a very, very recent book, and we'll talk about that. And then we're going to have a round of questions, which I've designed for my co-host, Mr. Jude Lovell here, because he is by far more knowledgeable in terms of, you know, what he's read and in the works of King that I am, although we've both read quite a bit. So that was a lot of talking about what we're doing. Jude, any comments on that? Or if not, we can get kind of right into our quick preliminaries, and then we'll dig into the topic of Mr. Stephen King.
Well, I might just point out that, you know, I hate to use a cliche, John, but Stephen King, because it's really becoming one now, but Stephen King is such a unicorn, John, you know, with his career and output, that we couldn't even, you know, just to build off what you said, not only did we decide to make it a two-part episode, but we couldn't even go the same path. Because normally when we tackle, for those of us, for those of you who have been listening to us for a while, you know, we tackle one writer and talk about their whole body of work or much of their body of work. We call it the dealer's choice episode. And we couldn't even kind of do that because his body of work is too large, you know. And, you know, it would be like a five-parter to do it that way. So we kind of had to create our own little format for Stephen King alone because of all, not only because of all the work and just how, I mean, unicorn is the right word, just how rare somebody like Stephen King is in the arts in general, you know, in terms of putting out so many works to discuss and you know, the way that his work has been received over many, many decades. Not only that, but I mean, we couldn't find another way to do it other than this. But having said that, I do like the then and now concept. It's kind of cool to, and that was John's idea. If anybody's keeping score, you can make a little hash mark next to his name to do then and now. Really early book, really late book, really cool idea. And then I'm sure John has cooked up a lot of interesting questions to get the discussion rolling, you know, kind of in the interim spaces. So yeah, so this is going to be great. You know, anybody who likes Stephen King or, you know, fiction in general, climb on. It's going to be a crazy ride.
Yeah, this is really going to be a lot of fun. We've been looking forward to this one for a long time. And, you know, just about everybody we know, I think you'd be hard pressed, if you're a reader in any way, I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who is an avid reader who hasn't read at least one book or story by Stephen King. It's like he's become so ubiquitous in the culture that, you know, that's one of the interesting aspects about his career, which we'll talk about. He seems, even though he's sort of like pigeonholed very often as a horror writer, he really kind of has something for everybody, which is one of the many fascinating and truly impressive aspects of this, you know, unicorn literary career, as you've called it. So this is going to be a lot of fun. Anybody who is, you know, familiar with the way we do this show knows that we generally take some time to talk about what we're reading now and what we're going, at the end of the show, we'll talk about what we're going to be reading next. We're going to do that really quickly up front here just because there's so much to cover. So we're just going to kind of get that stuff out of the way so that we can dive into Stephen King. So Jude, I'll pass it back over to you. Why don't you give us a quick, you know, couple lines about whatever you're reading now and what you plan to read next after that.
Okay, cool. Thank you. So I just started to read a book, kind of an unusual format. It's a story collection, but that also contains a novella, like a short novel at the end of the story collection. This is really a little bit odd. So the name of the book is called In the Valley. I won't get deep into it at all. The writer's Ron Rash from the Carolinas, from like that region of the world. American writer. I just want to say as a blanket statement to anybody listening to the podcast who enjoys literary fiction, maybe fiction set in like the Appalachian area, if you like novels and short stories, you should be reading Ron Rash. He's kind of one of our really slightly unsung great American fiction writers. I think even if you didn't really like the, you know, the material or the region or had something against it, you still should be reading Ron Rash for the quality of his writing. Just wanted to say that. This particular book is a collection of stories. It's called In the Valley, a collection of stories. It has about 8 or 9 short stories. And then at the end of the book, there's a novella, a new novella called In the Valley. And that's a little bit unusual too, because it's a bit of a sequel or a continuation of one of Ron Rash's most famous novels, which is called Serena. Came out in 2008. It's about this sort of like a Lady Macbeth type in the, you know, the Appalachian region in like the 30s and 40s, I believe, maybe the 50s, who kind of like in the novel Serena just like sort of helps her husband build this magnate of logging and then turns into a kind of Lady Macbeth figure. So that was a popular one of his novels. In the Valley, the novella is a continuation of her story. And so that's what I'm reading now, those stories from Ron Rash and the heading up to the novella. And then just really quick, what I'm going to read next is a novel, a relatively new novel, buzzy novel that's called The Rabbit Hutch. It's by a young woman, a debut novel from a young woman named Tess Gunty. That's in preparation for a future episode where John and I, just a little bit of a teaser, are going to be discussing this novel because it's kind of buzzy and unknown to both of us and won a major literary award. So I'm reading In the Valley. I plan to read The Rabbit Hutch, and I'll boot it over to you.
Well, that makes part of my job easy, because I too plan on reading that novel, The Rabbit Hutch, in anticipation of the show that we're going to do upcoming. And then in terms of what I'm reading now, I'm reading a really an awesome book that was a gift from you, kind of indescribable in a way. You can still hear me, right?
I can, yes.
Okay, I was getting a little bit of an echo there, so if listeners hear that, I apologize. But I'm reading an amazing book now. It's a memoir. We just did a show about all about memoirs, and it's too bad that I hadn't read this
right
yet, because it certainly would have come up. Gift from you, and it's the memoir from the great, great, still living, still working German filmmaker Werner Herzog. And
yes,
his memoir is famously, I say famously because it just came out, but it's going to be famous for this title. It's famously called Every Man for Himself and God Against All. And it's just kind of a compendium of stories about his incredible life, both as a filmmaker and as a person and as a world traveler and adventurer. Oh, man, how do you do that? I probably shouldn't even try to describe it because we said we were going to keep this short. But if you're not familiar with Werner Herzog, by the way, I heard in an interview, he said, you know, you should sort of pronounce it with a V if you want to try to be really German. But he said, he introduced himself as Werner, and he says, I just, in his inimitable accent, he's just like, just don't, you should say Werner, but don't even try. He says, like, he told the interviewer, just don't even try to say it that way. So however you say it, Werner, absolutely unbelievable filmmaker who's made just, you know, something like 70 or 80 films, many of which are unclassifiable. Some of his most famous films are Fitzcarraldo, Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World. There's so many that he's done. It's incredible. But as a writer,
Grizzly Man.
Yeah, that's one of his most famous ones. Bad Lieutenant, Border Call, New Orleans with a totally unhinged Nick Cage, which is, you know, you should see that just for that.
Right. Always a good time.
Yeah. Like, what is this iguana doing here, dude? But anyway. but
the iguana scene. Go find it, people.
Just go to YouTube it or something. I mean, anyway. But Werner Herzog himself has led a life that's even more incredible than any of the films he's made. And he has an inimitable speaking voice that most people would recognize. He has an inimitable writing style. This memoir is incredible. And it's just full of just one jaw-dropping story or anecdote after another. He's been everywhere on the planet. He's been in all kinds of incredibly dangerous situations, and he just relishes the adventure of life. It's really indescribable, but this memoir is really something. Jude, when you get to it, and I know you will, you're going to absolutely love it. You just can't believe some of the stories he's telling you. And then he just has such a unique perspective on the world and vision. He's just totally, you talk about a unicorn. There's another one. Just Werner Herzog.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Memoir is absolutely unreal. And I'm just highly enjoying it. So that, you know, someday that'll probably come up on another episode or something. But that, I think that kind of wraps up the preliminaries. You know, we've got a lot to cover with Mr. Stephen King. This has been brewing for a long time, as we've been saying. So I think it's just time to dive right into it. What do you say?
I agree. And even to bring it back to Stephen King, you know, Werner Herzog, you mentioned his voice, which is so unique. And he's like, that's one of the rare books that I would absolutely adore to hear on audio version. And the other person who can do that is Uncle Stevie. Because like when you, at least his memoir on writing, when you hear the version that he read himself, because he has a very distinctive voice as well. You know, like it's a whole different experience to hear Uncle Steve read his own memoir about writing. But that's just by way of segue. Please continue.
Yeah, and that's how I took in on writing as well. And it was just so... That's he doesn't have that many. He's actually got more than I thought. One of the ways, just kind of sort of like blending into the topic here, you know, one of the things I did, Jude, and we'll just kind of just wing it here. One of the things I did was I went and looked at, and I'm sure you've done this as a Stephen King quote unquote scholar, you know, or just a rabid fan, maybe not a scholar, but a rabid fan. And I use the term rabid on purpose because I think, you know, that Stephen King would appreciate that.
Right.
And I already said you're foaming at the mouth, so it all comes around.
Right. But I'm a regular Annie Wilkes.
That's right. Or Cujo. But anyway, right. here we go. We're off on the Stephen King train, and the thing's got no brakes, people. So that's why we needed at least two episodes. But one of the things I did, you know, just kind of thinking about this show, is I went and looked at a list of all of his work. And I was just looking for kind of his published books in order because I wanted to just kind of see, well, how many of these suckers have I actually read? And I did do that. We may touch on that later. But the list I found was all of his work, you know, published, unpublished, unmade screenplays or produced or unproduced screenplays. And my gosh, I mean, like the amount of work that he's put out is truly staggering. And most of us just know the published stuff and you just kind of your jaws on the ground, but he has got a ton of, you know, essays, speeches. He wrote a surprising amount of poetry. I didn't know anything about that. I don't think he's published a lot of it, maybe on his website or something, but there's quite a long list of poems that he's written. Many of them seem kind of personal. Anyway, I was about to say that, when you mentioned on writing and like, you know, he hasn't done that many nonfiction books, but I bet you if you go back and collect his, you know, introductions to other books or, you know, contributions to anthologies. I mean, hell, Stephen King, you'll probably remember this. I didn't. And I just saw on the list that he was tabbed to, he collected for in like 2011 or something. He was the editor for the, let's see if I get this right. Like they put out a collection of the greatest X writing of the year. And there was a collect like travel writing or the greatest essays of 2011. You know what I'm talking about, right? Like,
right. Are you talking about the Best American series?
Best American. Thanks. I couldn't.
Yeah.
The Best American series. One year, the Best American sports writing collection for, let's say it was 2011, was edited by Stephen King.
You know, oh, wow. That's fascinating.
I mean, it's just, yeah, when you look at all of his work, even the unpublished stuff, that kind of segues me in a weird way into what I was going to ask first more than anything, or just, and this is not, it's not that you'll have a definitive answer, but from our point of view, Jude, from the point of view of Jude and John Lovell, from the Book Exchange podcast, why are we doing this with Stephen King? Why him? Why dedicate a two-part episode to him? Can you just, and this is going to be very hard to do briefly, but can you try to make the case for why Stephen King is not only worth reading, but worth diving into deeply?
Oh, boy.
Good luck.
This is your revenge.
But you know what I mean. You know what I mean? It's like, what, you know, when you come down to it, what is it to you that is so impressive and so worth exploring about this American writer?
I really think, John, you know, of course, I've been thinking about his work for decades, and you have too, and stuff like that. And I do a lot of thinking about Stephen King's work, you know, right, when I'm reading him stuff. As you know, I read two or three books of his every single year, you know, and I look forward to it every time. I think it really boils down to, and this is part of his entire persona, okay, that spills out from books into life and kind of rolling back and forth like some kind of, you know, wave pool or something, John. Mm-hmm. I think it's his prodigious talent, unique talent, almost entirely unique talent, history, just for storytelling. And all I mean by that is, like, he's the writer who we talk so much about fiction and books and stuff being escapism, but Stephen King is kind of the epitome of that to me. He is like a friend, a neighbor, that when they start telling stories in the backyard around the, you know, the fire pit or something like that, you just cannot stop listening, and you just want the guy to never stop. And mm-hmm. there's some quality of his writing in almost everything he does that more than I think anybody that I've read before, you know, I would have to think and try to put somebody up against that, but I'd almost say more than anybody I've ever read before, who just has this incredible ability to not only to imagine amazing things, crazy things, you know, just there's no limits to his imagination. But it's not just that. It's kind of the way he tells it. And he takes you more than anybody else, I would argue, out of whatever is going on in your world and brings you into his world. And I think he does that in everything. You know, like all of his novels, all of his stories, a nonfiction book, he's like a buddy, you know, that just like yeah. can tell a really mean story. Because, you know, not everybody tells stories well. Writing is a whole other thing, but even just like in discourse, John, conversation, daily life. Stephen King is just an unbelievably prodigiously talented storyteller. You know, when he starts telling a story, you just want to hear it. And somehow, and this is part of his magic, he just makes you keep going no matter what it is. And time slips away. I really think that's kind of the major thing about his entire career. And I honestly think that's a tremendous service to the world and culture. If you want to forget about your life and have a distraction from what's going on in your world, you cannot find a better companion in a book than Stephen King. So I think it kind of boils down to that.
I think that's a great answer. You know, when you try, if you try to come up with a concise answer about what is it about Stephen King that makes him both unique and valuable, I think you've touched on a lot of it. And to me, I agree with everything that you just said. But to me, one of the most, and we've talked about this many times, and we'll get into it, you know, we'll touch on it throughout this whole conversation, I think. There's a couple other things about him that I think are almost totally unique, or he is by far the best at it. One thing that I think is almost totally unique of any writer that I've ever heard of is for somebody to be this successful and be, in a way, this accessible.
Mm-hmm.
He is the world's greatest selling novelist. But whenever you, up till very recently, you and I listened to some recent interviews with him, see him on TV, he's been giving speeches and talks for years and years and years. He always seems like the guy you describe, like your kind of eccentric neighbor, like on that one show where you had the neighbor who was never seen, but he would just talk over the fence. That's right. What Stephen King seems like. He's so down to earth. Even in his writing style, we've talked about this many times. You know, he'll just, if he wants to throw in a hilarious, you know, portmanteau cuss word that's like a combination of two words, he does. Just like you might in real life when you're frustrated, you might say shitbird or, you know, And he just throws it in there, and it's just funny. But he also, you know, pop culture references, brand names. He just doesn't care about throwing stuff like that in. One reason is because now he's Stephen King, and he can do literally whatever he wants. But another one is that it's just who he is. He's just this very down-to-earth guy. And I think that aspect of him is hard to extract from his success, if I'm saying that the right way. You know,
yeah.
Both in the way that he writes and in the way that he has just remained. He's kind of like America's author. This country should be so proud of Stephen King, you know? And when he won that award back in 2003, like a distinguished contribution to American arts and letters, it said. Now, from what I'm hearing, from what you're saying, that is 1,000% deserved. And I agree. He has, I mean, how many lives has he made more fun, made better, made more enjoyable made for a few hours here and there over the course of his, like, I don't know, 55-year-long writing career? The answer is countless, you know, and you're a guy who writes books. To have that kind of impact alone means he should be discussed and read and talked about for a long time to come. And the second thing I was going to say, let's see if I can remember it now. Oh, I just think I've thought this for a while. You and I have talked about this here and there. I'm not sure I've said it this way to you before. But I just think he is the great, he's the GOAT, the greatest of all time, at coming up with plausible scenarios that just would be totally terrifying or nerve-wracking, and but could happen. Let's see if I'm trying to say this right. Just coming up with scenarios that seem like they could happen in real life, and then just, you know, turning the crank on the remote, on the little like automatic mouse or whatever, or car, and putting it down and just letting it run. Like, what if this happened? What if a huge dome appeared over an entire town overnight? What would happen? Or what would happen if this car that you've been lusting over, in quotes, for years, and you finally get your hands on it, becomes real and is like demonic? Or what happens if your dog goes crazy? You know, there's so many examples. He is the very best. I would posit he is the greatest of all time at coming up with scenarios that could be real and letting them play out and seeing what happens, you know. And there's something about that inherently, I think, that fascinates everybody. You know, what if you woke up one day and you started getting thinner every day?
Right, you know, or
there's so many examples, dude. Like, you know what I mean? And you'd be like, what would that be like? Well, Stephen King will take you through what that would be like, and he usually brings it to a satisfying, if not grisly, conclusion, you know. And there's just something about that ability that I think makes him just so eminently readable.
And I just, if you don't mind, I'm gonna add two other things to the intro here about why Stephen King. So I just want to give a short example of something I remember from his actual work. Very short example that kind of speaks to what I'm saying. And I'll do that momentarily. But before that, just to add to what you were saying about, you know, the award he got and like the, you know, why are we talking about him and why is he so successful and so good and all that stuff. That I remember he also, received the Presidential Medal of Freedom or whatever that, you know, highest award is for artists, people who contribute to the culture. He got it from Barack Obama. It was sometime around 2011. You know, and I know Stephen King and Barack Obama were sort of, you know, on the same page politically. This, my comment has nothing to do with that. Whoever wrote the intro, it could have been Barack Obama himself because he's a smart guy, or whoever did it. There was a phrase in there when he was giving him the award, and it's very simple. It just said his, huge catalog of novels and stories have delighted readers around the world for over 50 years. That's as far as you need to go. You know, like to me, it's just such a simple statement, but that's why Stephen King, because his stories have just they bring to light, and they brought it to so many people around the globe. That's just an astonishing thing to leave behind. I really could argue for the big prize, the Nobel Prize in Literature. I could definitely make an argument for that. They're too uppity. They won't do it. But in terms of impact on humanity, you could definitely make an argument. And real quick, the other thing I want to say, this is just a good example for me, John, because I was thinking about this before we came on. I remember a line from the book The Shining, one of his famous books, that to me is a good example of the way he writes and tells stories in a way that almost everybody loves. And it's very simple. And by the way, I remember this line from when I read it the first time, because The Shining is one of the few major Stephen King books that I've read twice. I just reread it like 3 or 4 years ago. But the first time I read it, I was like 19. And I remember this line from the first time I read it. And it was it's something you'll recognize, this kind of thing. It's something he does all the time. Like he'll end a chapter this way or end a section this way. And it just keeps you going. But it speaks to the neighborly guy that makes you want to keep reading, because he just comes at storytelling in such an unobtrusive, kind of humble and honest way. So it's early in the book, and Jack Torrance in The Shining is interviewing for the job at the Overlook Hotel. Or no, he's getting relieved from one of his previous jobs. He's getting fired. And the boss says to him something at the end of the speech where he's terminated. The boss says something to him like, don't be upset, Jack, there's no hard feelings. And I remember the way Stephen King ended the chapter was this: but there were hard feelings, period. All kinds of them, and then move on to the next chapter. And it's that kind of thing to me that's like, because nobody, that's not great prose or anything, but that is so honest. Like, there were hard feelings. There were all kinds of them, And I love that example of that's how he writes, and you read that and you go, oh yeah, I've been there. Yeah. And that's the kind of writer that Stephen King is. Like, he just writes in a way that appeals to just everybody.
Well, I'm glad you said that last thing there at the end, because that's another aspect of his writing that I feel like we have to touch on. And then, so we can, I hope that we could just riff on Stephen King generally as we're doing for a little while. Then I think we should talk a bit about our own experience with him, like what we've read.
Okay.
Not the whole list. You've got a really long list, so I don't expect you to just rattle it off. But
No, I couldn't anyway. Yeah, I can't even remember.
But I actually wrote down a list of books of his that I've read, because I know it's not that many. So I thought I would just like we would normally do if we're not recording, just share that with you just for the heck of it. But there's a couple other aspects of King that I at least want to touch on. I mean, you could go on and on, like what. With my setup question, what is it about King that makes him unique or worth reading? If you had to distill it down to one word, by the way, maybe the best word would be imagination, because he just has such mm-hmm. incredible imagination, and he's able to, like you said, he's able to bring you into his world, and whatever's going on in his mind at the time, he's shared many, many times that a lot of times he just has images in his mind and he wants to just write a story about those images, and he just kind of sees where it'll take him. Many of his famous novels have started that way,
mm-hmm.
Including Fairy Tale. He described how, there's an image that he had and he wanted to pursue it and see what came out, So he has this unique ability of, he doesn't just have the incredible imagination, but he can bring you into whatever he's imagining, as you already said. So,
yeah.
But, of course, you can't, he's kind of, like I said, he's sort of pigeonholed as a horror writer. I think he's much more than that, but so many of his well-known books tap into fear. And that's another reason why I think he's so universal and so accessible and so relatable, is that he just is able to, capture or, tap into fears that we all have. Fear of dying, or the fear of, your family being in trouble, or the fear of the dark, or the fear of, the unknown. He just, you know, many writers tap into that, obviously, but he just seems to have, again, a unique ability to kind of tap into fears that are common to everybody. And I think that, I'm just going to leave it there, but I think that's one reason why he's so popular around the world, because, you know, as it's come up on the show before, the Emerson quote, the deeper down you get into somebody, the more they're like everybody, you know?
Right.
And it's like, right, everyone is afraid of the dark. Everyone in the world, if they live in a house, hears a noise downstairs and they don't know what it is, and their heart starts to beat faster.
Right.
Everyone's afraid of dying. Everyone's afraid of something happening to their loved one. You know, just he's just, but few writers are so good at just tapping into those universal fears and making them as accessible as Stephen King is. The last thing I want to say is, and I wasn't planning on saying this one, but I mentioned before, and again, this was an unplanned comment, but I said, as Americans, we should be very proud of Stephen King. And there's something about his writing, his body of work, that's kind of uniquely American, you know? We're not going to dive into that aspect so much, but it just occurred to me that I can't think of a single book or novel of his that is set anywhere other than America, unless it's set in a fantasy world. You know, like, he doesn't write about Europe. He doesn't write about, like, he doesn't do travel writing. It's kind of like most of his stories are situated, they just feel like they could come from any town USA, but the USA is kind of an important part of it. There's something, not that the USA is better than any other country, it's not that, but there's something, I'm almost not sure how to say it, but it links to what I was talking about before, his unpretentiousness, and he's just kind of everyman quality. There's just something that, like, his story seemed to fit in any small town anywhere in this country. You know, there's just, yeah, like, you know, the example is Derry, Maine, which, you know, a small, typical American small town where he said a lot of his stories. But there's just something sort of uniquely American about his writing as well. That when you said, you made that comment, like, he would never be considered for the Nobel Prize. I was thinking, well, in my mind, I went to, well, you know, you got to, as a minimum, you got to drink like a Heineken to be considered for the Nobel Prize.
Yeah,
but
right.
Stevie King is going to be drinking Schlitz or Miller Lite.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And that got me thinking.
Budweiser.
Budweiser. And I just thought, that's because he's just an American guy. I thought, there's something to be said for that about his books too. Is that whatever, for good or bad, and he's certainly a critic of the country. He's not saying USA or else, but there's something, you cannot separate the Americanness from his body of work, and I kind of like that, you know, as an American.
Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't think about that so much. I don't know if I've ever spent a lot of time thinking about it. Well, I've thought about him as a uniquely American writer for sure. But not so much about, has he set stories in other places? I'm sure he has, you know, and I'm sure I've read some
of those. But
I'm sure there are some. I want to say there are some short stories that might be set in England or something like that. For some reason, I'm thinking of the book Hearts in Atlantis, which I haven't even read. But anyway, I'm sure he's done that here and there. But by and large, you're right. I mean, he's definitely operating within our shores. And I don't know if it ever really occurred to me to have some good old fashioned, you're not supposed to do this these days, but like national pride for, you know, Mr. King, you know, and I think that's, to me, that's another likable aspect of him and fair game, you know?
Yeah. It's just something like, it just reminds me a little bit of like movies are a very American invention, but they tapped into something universal to everybody, and so they become a global phenomenon, but that's a very American art form.
Yeah, you're right. And you're right.
Stephen King is sort of like that, you know, like,
yeah,
he's,
yeah,
like, he's, there's this Americanness about his I don't know, his work and his appeal that could only come from here, it feels like, and yet at the same time it's able to translate all over it. That's all I can say. You can't really plumb into the mysteries of why that is, but it's just sort of all of these things are answering the question, which is like, there's really, when you look at King, you use the word unicorn. The more you look at it, the more you realize, man, there's really never been anybody like him. I'm not sure there ever will be again, you know?
No, and I mean...
So this is, pardon. If nothing else, this is a celebration of who Stephen King is, because he's still giving us pretty darn good stories and novels.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, we'll argue about his more recent work perhaps the next time and where it ranks with the rest of his work. But yeah, I mean, you know, the only thing that I can compare to him really is Charles Dickens.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, yeah. He was, in terms of popularity, prolific impact on readers around the world. Not Ms. Rowling with Harry Potter. She's up there for sure, but just because she has so much less work, you know, than Dickens or King, you know. But, you know, she probably has equally as many, if not more, readers around the world. But, you know, Dickens is the guy that I think of, you know, and, you know, he wasn't American. So, you know, and right. He didn't even like America much. So, like, you know, King is our guy.
Yeah, he is. But I think that's a really astute and good comparison. I'm sure you're not the first one to have made it, but I think it really works because, no, he wasn't American, but he was uniquely British. And I think in the same way, he kind of brought a British sensibility and culture in a way to the rest of the world through his stories,
mm-hmm.
You know, and the universal popularity of them. That's an interesting comparison, you know, and also just how wildly popular he was in his own time. I mean, he would go on, as you know, he'd go on these, you know, tours and perform passages from his books. And it's interesting that right. Stephen King, of the many things he has been, he's not really a performer. He's made, you know, he's made cameos in movies and stuff like that. But, you know, imagine if he was like this guy who liked to be under the lights of the stage. And if he like toured around and performed passages from his own books, I mean, it would just be insane, you know?
Yeah. Which he does. I mean, he does readings and stuff like that, but he, you know, yeah. He's not a guy that seems to really crave, you know, being up on the stage, you know, like Dickens would wear, you know, crazy outfits, and Stephen King will show up in a Ramones t-shirt and short and, you know, jeans from the beginning, you know, like, you know, so.
I love it. I absolutely love it. You know, that's one of many things to love about King. Well, all right. You know, this is kind of table setting. I also because this is just kind of a way to get into his vast body of writing. You know, obviously we're not going to cover anywhere close to all the books, but I, you know, titles are going to come up. I just thought I'd share with you, Jude, because, and this is kind of like, this is a portion of the show that's literally like a conversation you and I would have personally, but we're just going to let everyone else kind of listen in on it.
No. Right.
And in so doing, you know, they can think about their own experience with Stephen King. But I just, for the first time, Jude, in all these years we've been talking about King, I decided to list out what I've actually read by Stephen King. Okay.
And yeah. I can't wait to hear it.
It's a longer list than I thought, but yet when I put it all together and then I measured against the list of works, I was like, wow, there's so much King that I have not tapped. And so it would be interesting kind of hear you kind of react to this. But so here's a list of books, and I kind of put them in order of publication. Okay. Going back to the beginning. These are the list of books that I've read by Stephen King. Night Shift from 1977. The Long Walk, which I just read for this show. Dance Macabre, which I only read recently. So these are, that's at 1980. These are earlier works. Christine, mm-hmm. Pet Cemetery, which I'll just say right now, I think gun to my head or pushed up against the wall. Someone asked me, what's the scariest book that of Stephen King's that you know of? My answer would be Pet Sematary.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people might say that. But Skeleton Crew, another short fiction collection. By the way, I always thought that Night Shift was the first book that I ever read by Stephen King, Jude. But I think Skeleton Crew was, because I remember the story about the monkey.
Yeah.
So right. Anyway... I think that was the first, literally my first introduction to Stephen King, which is all the way in 1985. So he'd already been writing for, you know, that 10, 12, 15 years. Misery, great book. The Dark Half, which is about, in a way, it's about twins.
Right.
And then there's kind of a gap, and I read Desperation, which was in the mid-90s. The Green Mile, which was a serialized book that I think a lot of people found interesting and was made into a movie. The Memoir on Writing. The book Sell, 2006. And then that was, this is what I kind of wanted to build up to. That was, when we decided to do the show and said we're going to do Then and Now, we're going to read a recent book by King, I thought, what was the most recent book that I've read by King? Well, it was Sell.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And that's from 2006. So I bring that up because obviously he's had a ton of books between Sell and I think his most recent book now is Holly.
Mm-hmm.
But you've read a lot of those books in between Sell and Holly, right? Or at least a handful.
Isn't yeah, at least a handful. Yeah, a number of them. Yeah, Mr. Mercedes, yeah. Billy Summers, Now Fairy Tale, perhaps others.
Joyland, I think.
Joyland, yes. I did read Joyland. And then, you know, there's Dark Tower books. There's one or two that came out after Sell. Or maybe not. No. I don't think that's right. I think he finished Dark Tower, and Sell was one of the first books he did after Dark Tower.
Oh, okay. Wow. I mean, Dark Tower cycle itself is at least 7 books, right?
Yeah, that's at least one episode of the show. Yeah. The Dark Tower is 7 books, and that's a whole other – it'll come up, but that's a whole other thing, you know.
Yeah, so one thing I wanted to point out to you is that there is a 16-year gap between any other Stephen King book and reading Fairy Tale for this show, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, I didn't realize
it had been that long. So for me personally, this show was a bit of revisiting an author that I hadn't read in a really long time. Not the case for you, but that's the way it was for me. The other thing I just wanted to observe is that that's only 13 books. Like, how many books does he have? He has like over 70, doesn't he?
Yeah, like 70 or 75, yeah.
So just writing that out, I was like, man, I even though I feel everybody sort of feels like they know King because he's so much a part of the culture. I mean, he's in so many movies and adaptations, and I've seen many of the movies where I haven't read the books, you know, The Shining being a glaring example. But so you kind of feel like you know King, but I was like, you know, you make a pie graph, and I've only got a small little slice of that pie. I wonder how big the slice would be for you. And we're not going to be able to calculate that, but do you think you've read half of what Stephen King has written, or probably, right? Like,
I don't know if I have read half. I might say over 30, so close to half. I would have to go back and find out. You know, more than you, but not maybe it's half. You know, but the other thing that's interesting to me about your list is that there, you know, a number of really canonical Sting books that King books, and you and I have talked about this, that you haven't read. If you know, Cujo, Salem's Lot, The Stand, The Shining, you know, It, you know, so, you know, I mean, that is what it is, you know, that's interesting.
Well, the reason I'm glad you brought that up, because like we've had talks about, like, and even on this show, I've talked about, you know, like what you just said, like there's some major, major King books that I haven't dug into that you have. So another thing I did, and this is just for fun, okay? So I looked at the list, and I thought, like, here's a list. Before I kick the bucket, before I croak, I want to at least have read these books by Stephen King, okay?
Okay.
So I put together a little list. You ready?
Yeah.
So one is The Shining, because that's, like you said, it's amazing I haven't read that. Never read it, you know. It's an iconic movie, but most people know that Stephen King didn't like the movie. So I've always been curious about that, but for some reason I've never read it. The Stand, you might be surprised to hear that that's on the list, because one of the things, we'll get into this, one of the things that kind of bothers me about King is that he just has no editor, apparently, because he just goes on, and you feel like there are like wide swaths of some of his books that could be cut out.
Yeah.
At least in my opinion. But The Stand is like this monumental doorstop of a book. But still, it feels to me like one of the greatest creations that he's ever come up with. And it also has to do with like a worldwide pandemic. You know, there's a lot of reasons why that's on the list, but it's really
I know it's come in two versions. I think you may have read them both, or you read the longer one, but I mean, it's insane. It's over 1,000 pages.
Yeah, I did read them both, actually. Oh, I read the long one, the uncut one, years and years ago, like teens or early 20s. And then I recently reread it, but the beat up paperback version I had was the original version. So,
wow. A book that you might be surprised to learn is on this list is that you're going to, I know you're going to be like, what the hell is the Tommyknockers?
Oh yeah. No, I, that's on my list. I haven't read too. And I get it.
It's not known to be one of his best books. I think I read somewhere that it's like the last book that he wrote when he was still kind of struggling with cocaine and alcoholism and was kind of a mess personally before he got cleaned up.
Right.
But the reason it's on the list is and this is what I was talking about before with like fascinating situation. Like I went back and read what that book is about, like the setup for that book. And it just sounds fascinating to me. It's like right. Some kind of metallic object in the dirt that's having this effect on this town. And this one woman gets obsessed with it and has to figure out what it is. And again, set up the car and go. Where does it go from there? I think that just really intrigues me. It might be a wretched book. But, you know, there's something about that premise setup I think is really fun. I kind of hesitate on this one because I'm not sure whether you've read it or not. But for some reason, it's of his recent work. It's one of his most highly regarded books, and that is 11/22/63,
mm-hmm.
which is like about the Kennedy assassination. But it sort of takes those events and he kind of weaves them into some kind of fantastic scenario. Or time travel scenario or something like that. But I know that the year that came out, it was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times. So I'm kind of intrigued, you know, that way. And another one is, I already mentioned it, Under the Dome. Like, again, I don't know anything about that book, but I just think it's interesting. The town wakes up to find that the entire town is covered by this like force field. And so they're completely isolated. That's all I know. But I just think that sounds like a really kind of a cool setup. And I think that's one of the books that you haven't read, right?
Yeah, I have not read the last two you mentioned, two very big books from slightly more recent years. And I have not read either one of those, 11/22/63 or Under the Dome. And I'd love to read both of them. Under the Dome in particular is, you know, one of these books, from, you know, some of them are just, you know, sell some weird alien, you know, brainwave or, you know, signal has like turned everybody who has a cell phone into like ravenous monsters. But I guess there could be, you know, some depth to that. Where I was going was Under the Dome is one of his concepts that seems very rich in metaphor, you know, you're talking about blocking off your community from the rest of the world, literally, you know,
right.
And what would happen. So.
Yeah, just another fascinating idea. And there's one other thing I'll throw in there, and this came out a while ago. And I don't know much about it, but I know that he wrote like a short, it's not even a novella, but it's like maybe a book-length essay, and it's called Guns. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
Go ahead. You can go.
He wrote like a long essay about the problem of guns in America. So it's nonfiction. There's nothing fantastic about it. And I, like you mentioned before, you know, like he has certain political views that you can agree with or disagree with, but for someone who's written so much about violence and in fact, you know, wrote a book about a school shooting decades before there, you know, they became unfortunately a common event. I always was curious about that. And I think that would be interesting to read just to kind of get another sort of aspect of King's thinking. So I don't know. Did you ever read that?
No, I don't even know how you really find it. Very John F. Lovell inclusion on your list, but I applaud that choice though, because it'd be very interesting to, you know, it's just the unique irony, I guess, of this particular writer taking on that subject when he's written so much about violence and death. Would be interesting to consume, you know?
Well, that's the thing. I always thought, like, when that came out, which was maybe about 10 years ago, And I think it was Amazon who had like a series of short writings on topics by famous writers, let's say. And I thought, whoever had the idea to have Stephen King write about guns and gun control, that's a pretty interesting idea. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah.
You know, guns are prominent in the book we're about to talk about, which is A Long Walk.
Right.
So anyway, that's just sort of a short list of books that I'd like to read from King that I haven't. And all of that is just to say, is to kind of highlight, number one, how vast and broad the work of the body of work of King is. Cause I feel like, you know, I look at that list. I'm like, yeah, I've read a good chunk of King, but I really haven't. And the fact that you have at least doubled what I've read, and yet that doesn't even, you know, really come close to encompassing all of King's work, I think is just staggering.
Bananas. Yeah.
The second reason I want to go through that little exercise is to say that, you know, later on, and I think in part two, you know, and even in this part, to some extent, you know, I'm asking the questions to you about Stephen King. And the reason is simply that, you know, of the two of us, you're just much more aware and kind of steeped in King's work than I am. And so I'm kind of using you as our in-house expert for all things Stephen King, even though there's plenty of, you know, King material that you haven't read. I think it's just, you know, as far as this conversation goes, you know, you're the expert in the room. So I'm just going to sort of play host a little bit and ask you some questions, but hopefully that's a good way to, you know, kind of take the, you know, can opener to the whole topic and kind of sort of dig in. So that's how we're going to play it.
Yeah, well, that works. I certainly don't claim expertise, but I think I probably have done a lot more thinking about Stephen King's, you know, the, you know, writing and the methods behind his madness, etc., because he's just one of the, there's no question he's one of the greatest influences on me writing-wise. It just has to be that way, even though what I write doesn't really resemble his. It's just, you know, we could talk about at some point just why he's so influential for writers in particular, you know?
Right, right. All right, well, we're going to take a quick pause and then we'll come back and we're going to start, you know, as I said, it's Stephen King then and now. So we're going to start by taking a look at a very, very old work of Stephen King's. In fact, I learned through doing this, preparing for this show, that this is actually the first novel that he ever worked on, even though it was not the first novel that he published. It's called The Long Walk. Eventually it was published in 1979. When we come back, we're going to start to dig into that book. All right?
Sounds good.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to dive into Stephen King's 1979 book, The Long Walk. This is the then portion of the podcast, as we've described. One of his earliest books, as I just mentioned, as a matter of fact, supposedly, when he was a freshman at the University of Maine, he was already starting work on this book. That makes him about 18 years old, you know, when he was writing the majority of it, Jude, which is pretty amazing right out of the gate.
Yeah.
As I've mentioned, I think most people who know anything about King know that his first novel published was Carrie, 1975,
right.
Jude?
You know? Four.
1974. This book, The Long Walk, came out under a pseudonym. The pseudonym is Richard Bachman. Came out in 1979. Now, and it eventually became part of what's known as the Bachman books, which are four shorter, well, this novel's not that short, but four novels written under the pseudonym Richard Bachman. That when King became more popular, they were sort of compiled into a collection called the Bachman books. I should have researched this, but I have a feeling that you might know something about it. Do you know what was the reason why Stephen King started to publish books, and specifically like earlier books that he worked on under the name Richard Bachman? Do you know?
Well, there was an omnibus that came out in the 80s called the Bachman books after he was like outed as Richard Bachman. So they collected the four novels that were written as Richard Bachman that were published at the time. And later there was another one called The Regulators later in, I think, in the 90s, late 80s or 90s. Mm-hmm. But basically, you know, long story short, I think it was like a driven by the publishing industry at the time. So Stephen King had written these other books and he was taking off as a writer. And he, you know, they were trying to capitalize on his popularity. But it was against the kind of unwritten rules in the industry that you come out with two books from the same author at the same time. And in the same year, pardon me. So somebody had the idea. So it had to do with the publishing machine. So somebody had the idea to come up with a pseudonym and publish some of the books they were interested in publishing that way. Stephen King famously came up with the name Richard Bachman. I think Richard came from, if I have this right, like either a serial killer or somebody famous that he had heard that was in the news at the time. And then he was in the car driving around and a song by Bachman, Turner Overdrive, came on. You know, so this places it in time. So he chose the name Richard Bachman. That's how he came up with Richard Bachman. And
that's so Stephen King, though.
It is. It's so great. Classic rock, you know. Or, you know, contemporary rock at the time, I guess. Radio rock, whatever. And he liked that idea. And I guess what happened was somebody outed him. I think it was a British journalist, you know, after two or three Bachman books came out, because he really was not interested in being found out. Somebody, because he was so ravenously popular even back then, did some research and put it together, figured out it was Stephen King, published a review that's like, hey, this is Stephen King, and I'll bet the ranch on it. And Stephen King didn't really fight it that hard, you know. He just kind of said, well, yeah, you know, the jig is up, those books are mine. Mm-hmm. And that's basically how it happened. And then, you know, he had made up this backstory about how Richard Bachman died, you know, tragically. I forget how, but like in the 80s or something, you know. And so that was the end of him. And then they eventually published one more, which was The Regulators, which, you know, it's a separate story, but like a little bit later on.
Well, you probably read about that one too.
I have read that. You know, the funny thing is I didn't read the companion novel that you did read, which was called Desperation, which was published under Stephen King's name.
Yeah, that was in the 90s. They published both of them on the same day. You know, they made a big, huge splash about that. I remember that pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. At a Barnes &
Noble. So I remember setting up like displays that had books on.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I was working at a Borders bookstore for a big release of his in the 90s also, but a different book. I remember.
What was the book?
The big deal. The book was Bag of Bones, 1998, and the big deal they made out of that, you know. And the other thing is, this is just a side note, but like Stephen King has actually done a lot of things, you know, either him or his handlers that were innovative that other people haven't done. One of them was that famous twin book dropping, you know, Bachman and Stephen King, and the covers like mirrored each other, you know, like. You remember that, like the cover for Desperation, you could see like through the window on the cover of the Regulators, you know, like,
yeah.
So like, I think there was a lot of interesting. He also was one of the very first people to ever do and what's now called an e-book or an e-story around like 2000. It was called Riding the Bullet. It was like very experimental and it kind of crashed and didn't even come to an end.
Yeah.
You know,
he's done a lot of, I mean, he did the serialized Green Mile.
Right. Yeah, that was my point.
Done before, obviously, but you know, yeah.
It was like a throwback, though, to like the old way of because they re-released them in like really short portions, one at a time.
Yeah. Really cool stuff. Really interesting. So yeah, didn't he like, maybe this is apocryphal, but didn't he also have like a, wasn't there like a grave for Richard Bachman or something in his backyard or like?
Maybe. Yeah, there was a whole like death of Richard Bachman, you know, like.
Yeah, anyway. Again, it's Stephen King. I mean, he's just like stories within stories. But
right.
Anyway, we were talking about doing a very early King story for this particular concept that we have going here for this episode. And I think it just dawned on us both that neither of us had read a lot of the Bachman books. So, and we knew that they were early, so we just decided, kind of picked one at random. And the four Bachman books, just for the record, are the Running Man, which is probably the best known because it was made into a movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Richard Dawson, let's not forget, from Family Feud, which if we haven't dated ourselves already, we just did. But
right.
So yeah. The Running Man, and then there's a, I thought, an interesting sounding novel called Roadwork, which is about just about a guy whose house is going to be razed, you know, because they want to build a new highway, and he's kind of right in the way. And as a good friend of mine said, that's basically the same exact plot as Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, just on a more galactic level. No, which is
And the Lorax by Dr. Seuss.
And the Lorax.
It's like, it's kind of the same idea, you know?
Yeah, but anyway, this individual guy, kind of a loner, fights back from that. And then the third one was called... Now I'm drawing a blank here. What's the third one that's not The Long Walk?
It's called Rage.
Rage. I mentioned it before because it has to do with a school shooting, which is kind of eerie.
Right.
And then,
sorry, go ahead. You might be saying what I was about to say. Go ahead.
Well, the next one is The Long Walk, which is the one we're going to talk, one we ultimately decide to read, and the one we're going to talk about. So were you going to say something about The Long Walk, or should we just tee it up?
No. Well, we are in 2 seconds, but I just forgot. There is another Bachman book. It's called Blaze, and I don't know exactly when that was written. Blaze.
Yeah, we don't know when it was written, but it was released much more recently, right?
Right, yeah, like in the last 15 years or so.
Yeah, I noticed that one too in the list. I don't even remember that one coming out. And I don't know if it's as old as some of these, or I don't know. Who knows?
I don't know, yeah.
But that, you know, the Richard Bachman guy is just like, you know, he's hard to kill. It's like Pet Sematary. Keeps coming back out again.
right.
Which is, I'm sure, by design. But anyway, The Long Walk is, the premise of the book, of the novel, is very, very simple. It's kind of like you gather through reading the book. It's like sort of an alternative America. Exactly when it's set, we don't really know, at least not precisely. But they have a kind of, there's a kind of, there's sort of almost a precursor to like reality TV. There's the government
yes.
has, it's almost like a lottery where if your name is chosen, you got to be between a certain age, you got to be a young male, and you can be chosen. Well, crucially, you can volunteer to take part in what's called the Long Walk, which they do every year. And you get the impression that it's done somewhere in America. It's sort of like an American pastime or sport or like show. And you can volunteer to be a walker. And this is one of the central, I'll just get right in, one of the central questions of the book, by the way, is why in the world would you volunteer to do this? But you can volunteer to be a part of the Long Walk, which is basically takes place over 4 days. And you have to walk a certain, you know, really long distance of time, of space. And if you slow your pace below 4 miles an hour, you get killed. And if you don't finish the walk, you get killed. So it's
well,
like,
you get warned. You get warned.
Well, you get, yeah, there's a series of warnings, but yeah, you get warned 3 times. And then on the 4th time, you're executed. And so,
right.
And it's a voluntary activity, but everyone in America kind of watches it. It's like the Super Bowl, the World Series combined into one, combined with a reality, you know, TV show. And that's the premise. And you have a protagonist is somebody who volunteers to be, or at least in air quotes, volunteers to be part of this long walk. And he goes on the long walk and meets a whole bunch of other young people who are doing the long walk. And so, you know, from the very beginning, there's only going to be one guy standing or walking at the end. And that's the setup, you know. And then there's, you know, swirling around the book is all kinds of questions like, why is this, you know, why is this happening? Why would you volunteer for it? What is the point of the long walk, et cetera, et cetera. But it's kind of this dark vision of this sort of, you know, sport / pastime that is set in this alternative version of the United States. And you're just kind of, you literally sort of walk along with the main character, who's a guy, what's his name? Just lost
Garrity.
Garrity. Ray Garrity. And you, right. And through Ray Garrity's eyes, you meet a whole bunch of the other walkers, and you go with them on this long walk until, you know, it comes to its conclusion. And that's pretty much a setup for the book. Is there anything I missed here? Anything else you want to say about what the book's about?
No, I mean, I think you basically got it. There's kind of like a villainous figure called the Major, who's like the head of the guys that execute people, you know, follow along in like Jeeps or whatever, vaguely, you know, Stalinistic military types, you know?
Yeah.
But no, and, you know, he figures into it a bit. And what's the other thing? The only other thing I was going to add was that I got the impression. So King was writing this in the 60s, all the way back in the 60s. I got the impression that it was sort of a little bit forward in time, a little bit futuristic, maybe not that much, like maybe, you know, 10 years ahead or 15 years ahead or whatever. But that's the impression that's a feeling I got, but I don't know that for sure.
I got the same feeling too, actually. It's just, it's not really like a lot in the book. It's not really specified.
Right.
Exactly when this is, exactly what the long walk is, exactly whose idea it was, you know, and in that way to kind of get into, that's what the book's about. That's the setup for the book. And then what we're going to do is just share our impressions of it. And then probably more in part two, but, you know, we'll start to draw some comparisons and contrasts between, you know, reading Fairy Tale, which came out in 2022, and this book, which is written literally in the mid 60s. I mean, that's a huge gap in between. So it'll be interesting to kind of see what feels like the books have in common and what might feel different. But right away, this book, it's like I said, it kind of sets up this scenario and kind of winds up the toy, and you just sort of see where it goes, you know? And there's not a lot of, one of the things I really sort of appreciate about this book is the gaps in information or the gaps in details. You really don't know, and you never find out definitively what the long walk is all about, why they do it, why someone would volunteer for it, and what its ultimate purpose is. I think even going back to like this early, you know, again, he's 18 years old, but I think he was smart enough and had good enough instincts, even as an 18-year-old, to not spell all of that stuff out and leave a lot of that to the interpretation of the reader. So right out of the gate, I personally found those aspects of this book to be impressive, that he just sort of sets up an interesting scenario and sees where it goes, and he deliberately does not over-explain. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, that was going to be one of my main points also, although I'm not, you know, I was pretty confident you saw the same thing, you know, like he, and to me, it's like demonstrative. Again, I was talking about that prodigious talent he has for storytelling, and this is part of it. Like, you know, and it also has to do with the influence on writers, because I, you know how I come at things, and so do our listeners by now, you know, because I'm looking at it because I like to write books as well. And the fact, look, I mean, you know, being 18, 19, you know, I started creative writing around the same age, 19. I think I was, the first novel I finished was in 2013. You know, I didn't even know how to, you know, start a book and end it. And for him to be able to just write a whole novel at that age, and I feel like it took me many years. In fact, I feel like I'm still working on it. And I think all writers are always working on this to leave out the baggage. For him to know to leave out, you know, that's one of the great virtues of the long walk. Like that, all the, exactly what you said. It doesn't over-explain it. It doesn't over-explain it. And he knew that you didn't need to. You just kind of drop them in, and you're off and running from like page two. Which I think, I'm just saying, that took me a very long time to figure out how to do that. And he had it from the jump. That speaks to his great talent, you know.
I think so. And, you know, like we could, as we talk more about King, you know, there are many books in his corpus, you know, or in his body of work that I think a generous way to say it would be feel bloated or feel like they could have been cut down.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
sure.
Even this one has a simple premise. And I, again, I apologize to listeners who might be hearing an echo. I think it kind of comes and goes. I really have no idea why it's happening, and I'm just going to kind of push forward. So if that's a distraction, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't hear it, but I'm sorry. Yeah, it's hard to speak with it.
I think it may come through on the recording, which I regret, but we'll push forward. Even this book, you know, he said he has a simple premise, and the book does go on for about 400 pages, you know, so it could definitely have been short.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I really appreciate, we talk about, you know, not having to spell everything out, but I thought I was really, this book impressed me as a King book and also as, for, you know, coming from somebody who's so young, but even in up against other King books, I just thought he had a really good idea. He set it into motion. And what really impressed me the most about this particular book, I'm not going to say it's the best book he's ever written, but he drops enough interesting little clues and hints that kind of speak to, that kind of let you know that we're, that America, the America in this book is not the America, exactly the America that we live in, even at the time that we were living in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something slightly off. And he drops these little hints throughout the book that kind of let you know that something has altered in American society, that makes it, you know, quite a bit different from what we're used to. And that is never explained, but he gives you enough information to know that things are different. And, you know, I could think of different examples of that. But like there's, at one point he says, he talks about the 51 states of America, for example, which we all know there are only 50, you know. So it's just, and that's just a little historical detail that he throws in there. Another one, for example, and this, it's done so subtly that it kind of throws you off. I don't know if you remember this, Jude, but you're kind of reading it. At one point, one of the characters or somebody mentions the German bombing of the East Coast of the United States. Did you pick up on that? Like,
no, so far I'm over two on those two things you picked up. I really didn't, you know, but I did pick up on the feeling that you're not quite living in, you know, your father's USA or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I had to go back and read it twice because he says something about when the Germans strafed the East Coast. I was like, what?
That sounds like something that the guy at Faber College, played by John DeLucci, would have come up with. You know, like, you know, were you there when the Germans bombed, you know, the West and East Coast?
Exactly. But I went back twice and I read it, and it definitely alludes to that. And then there were enough of these that I was like, okay, he is kind of, you know, and there's a political figure that's called something like the corporate governor of Maine or some kind of like position that doesn't exist. You know? Mm-hmm. So there are these little, this very little subtle hints throughout the book that, you know, saying that this is not quite the America that we know. And I thought, this is an 18-year-old, you know, like. So it's not just the premise of the walk. I guess this is what I was driving at, dude. And this is one connection all the way to the 2022 book, A Fairy Tale, is that is the world building. You know, he was building an alternate world here.
Right.
Suddenly. And he obviously, by the time you get to Fairy Tale, spoiler alert, which is about a, you know, an alternate world within our world. You know, he's doing the same thing. He's like building this other world. It's, in that case, it's much more overt. But the roots of his ability to create another world are all the way back here in, when he was 18 years old, which I thought pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Now, I don't wish to upend your argument because I think you make the point you're making is a really good one. And I just said I didn't notice half of those details. However, you could argue that it's not that subtle, you know. Do you remember the German bombing of the East Coast? Wink, wink. You know, we're not in Kansas, Toto, or whatever, or the corporate governor of Maine. To me, that's not that subtle, not to, you know, push back on your thinking.
Yeah.
What is interesting is the fact that he was 18 and that he had techniques at his disposal to kind of show you whether they were subtle or not. This is not, you know, we're in a different place now. And the world building you're talking about, and you just kind of rolled all the way up to Fairy Tale. You just kind of roll with King. It's part of his voice and his his magic, really. Like, you know, and again, the fact that he could do this at 18 or 19, I couldn't finish anything at 18 or 19. And everything I came up with is drivel. Now, speaking of drivel, I pointed out a couple lines from from this book just to show, like, you know, Stephen King has never been, like, an amazing pro stylist. You know, however, he can come up with some really good lines. There's one in that I want to point out when we talk about Fairy Tale in the next part of this. But, you know, here's a just to show you, like, you know, he was still it's fascinating because he had so much that he could do and he had so much that he would eventually be better at. One sentence here from The Long Walk says, but it wasn't a game anymore. It was a three-dimensional reality. And the possibility of walking into Freeport on nothing but a pair of bloody stumps seemed a horribly possible possibility. So that was like one sentence with three forms of the word possibility in it. You know, very clunky. And then at certain points you felt like, and this is true of almost all King to this day. And, it, you know, it's kind of a thing, an appealing thing now. But sometimes you feel like it's just written by literally like a 15-year-old. You know, there's like a time, I've got it right here. It says they're approaching this last big hill before Freeport. Finally, they breasted it, parentheses. Carolyn had nice breasts. She often wore cashmere sweaters, close parentheses. And I was like, this is like a 14-year-old writes this book, you know, breasts. I get it. You know, like.
They breasted the hill.
Yeah, they breasted the hill. And by the way, Carolyn had some great, you know, a great set of whatever, whatever. You know, like. It's really funny, but it's like,
he's 18,
you know, he was 18, you know, now it's a detriment. I would argue it's a detriment because he still does quite a bit of that. And he's like 72. That's a whole different matter,
yeah.
You know, but then again, that speaks to his unpretentiousness. He just, it's again, it's like your 72-year-old dude neighbor next door probably is going to talk about someone's boobs. You know, I hate to say it,
yeah.
You know, yeah. But anyway, but yeah, it's like but the larger point is, what he was able to do sort of technique-wise at that young of an age. And this book really sucks you in, you know? And then you're again, by like page two, you're off on the long walk and you're going.
Well, yeah, with that premise, you know, it's kind of inherent in it is just you want to know, obviously, who's going to win, you know, and how is this going to work out? It's like, you know, watching the reality TV show Survivor or anything. You know, where there's like, it all whittles down to one candidate, you know. And by the way, I mean, it's like, this is decades and decades before something like the Hunger Games, you know. Like, can you still hear me?
Right. Yes, I can.
Okay. Like, that's, you're sort of like, that's one series of books that I was like, well, this is like, you know, this is like totally a precursor to the Hunger Games. And many other, you know, fantasy novels or novels in general, you know, he was doing this long before these people were even born practically, you know?
Right. Totally.
I guess the point, I heard what you were saying before. One of the points I was making with these little subtle change, I keep using the word subtle and you're saying it's not that subtle.
Well, it's a small minor point, but yeah.
Well, so that maybe not the right word, but what it does do is it, everything's political, right? It brings a little bit of a political element into the book, which was not a mistake. But again, as an 18-year-old, and one of the things, I mean, it's pretty obvious, you know, if you read this book and you understand that he's writing it in the mid-60s. I don't know if this is literally true, but I have to believe that some of what went into this book was the experience of being an 18-year-old at a time when they have a public draft going on for the Vietnam War.
Right.
So I, you know, that seems to be, that's a pretty clear, you know, that was definitely going on in our society, you know, the American society that is real, that we did know at that time. And I know I have some friends who are around the same age as Stephen King, and I've heard them talk about what it was like to either listen on the radio or watch on TV and wait for your name to be called or your number to be called. It's actually a number. And the anxiety of thinking, if my number's called, what's going to happen? And so that's just a whole other aspect of this book that I find really interesting, is that he, you know, maybe some of his fears, anxieties about, you know, being of age at a time where there is a public draft is going on for war. This is how it came out in his fiction. And I think that's a really interesting aspect of it. So there's a political element to this book, which I don't think I really expected. I'm not saying it's super sophisticated, but you know, some of these comments he makes about the society that America has turned into, you know, this anxiety that was everywhere, especially around young men at this time, that you could be drafted, and you know, you could all of a sudden be, you know, putting yourself in harm's way. And so these, you know, these squads that would follow the walkers that are, you know, just basically feel like military vehicles with people with guns, and they would just pull you out and shoot you. I mean, these are just kind of like manifestations of, I think, of real anxieties at the time. And just not, I didn't really expect that from one of the Bachman books. I expected, like, I don't know, maybe it's like
The Mangler. You know,
yeah, The Mangler or Arnold Schwarzenegger and The Running Man, you know.
Right.
This book had some sophistication and some real anxiety that's being expressed through it that I didn't expect. Another thing I want to point out, and I don't know if you felt this way, dude, about this book, but I felt like this book had kind of a sad, you know, a sad, wistful mood to it throughout most of the book. Which mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be more like just kind of a sci-fi story or something, or a dystopian thing. I didn't expect it to be. It felt like a pretty emotional book to me, because you get to know these young kids and then you see them being picked off. Then you gradually learned, like, one guy actually had a wife and a kid. One guy was, you know, some of the people are like have been picked on their whole lives. I don't know. I guess I just didn't really expect this book to have such a sad, and like I said, a kind of a sad and wistful feel to it. It wasn't, it's an interesting story, but it's not like a laugh riot by any means. I felt it was fairly emotional. What did you think? Like, did you pick up on some of that at all? Or were you just like, oh, this is an interesting premise, let's see where it goes.
No, I think you're making a lot of great points. I love, you used this word many times, but I didn't think about this. And I love the one word that you could almost use to characterize the entire book would be anxiety, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it is a fraught or tense tale in some ways. And yes, like you can, you know, those were the things about this book that were impressive to me. I'm not totally sure that I liked it as much as you did. I thought it drugged slowly a lot of the book until the end. But the things that impressed me were, again, at such a young age, and I think about my own struggles with storytelling, you know, between the ages of, say, 20 and 50 or 40. Some of the just techniques that were used, like the very notion of having a tale that gets going quickly and it's all about attrition keeps you going right along, you know, like you're not going to stop because people are just, it's like 10 Little Indians or, you know, classic storytelling again that he just kind of got at such a young age. It's incredible. And the other thing about it, John, is like, I did feel some of those, I'm impressed too with the fact that you got, again, at first I couldn't even tell between the people, but you did get to know them a little, and then the deaths started becoming more meaningful to you. And at the same time, classic King, the deaths were more, there was plenty of grisly deaths, you know, like, and they were coming with, you know, they gave you like the blood and the gore that like he came to be associated with. You know, I might argue that he didn't even start as a horror writer. And I don't think he's ending as a horror writer, but he obviously became famous as a horror writer. Hmm. But like, so you had the violence and the blood for the people that like it, but you also had some emotional aspects. You're right. And you had a whole structure or conceit or concept that was going to bring you along just by design, literally by design, you know, it's a game of attrition. and you want to see who's number one at the end. Incredible. Like, I could not have done that anything close at age 18. I'm not saying it's a, you know, I didn't think it was a great work of literature, you know, but there was enough there to, like, really make it impressive. I understand why they wanted to publish it, you know, because it's a good read.
Yeah, it's a pretty, it may not be great, it's pretty good. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I don't know if this is true at all, dude, but, like, some of what you're saying reminds me of a note I had written down. I kind of, in my head, you know, as I was reading this book, it reminded me of two famous books, or one's a story, one's a book, that he would have been aware of, I think, that most people our age are aware of, or maybe even had to read in school. And the connective tissue with these two I'm about to mention in this book is that I think in all, and I thought about this later, the books popped into my head as I was reading it, but then I thought later, oh, see that? The reason I'm reminded of these books is because all three of these stories feature people dying off, and they're people in stressful situations, mm-hmm. to say the least. And this is the key connector that made me think of The Long Walk in association with these two other works, is that you felt the deaths, like you felt them mm-hmm. emotionally. One is The Lord mm-hmm. of the Flies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because that, you know that situation, a bunch of guys, in this case, they are young males as well, stuck on an island. And everybody remembers when Piggy died, you know, like, but a lot of these deaths, you really felt them because you'd spent time with these characters. So this reminded me of that. The other one is The Lottery by Shirley Jackson.
Yeah. Yep.
Who we know is an influence. We know that King appreciates Shirley Jackson.
So, and Lord of the Flies, that comes up in, if it does not come up in The Long Walk, I think it may be in the essay, Why I Was Bachman, where he was explaining.
Oh.
Lord of the Flies is in there somewhere.
Okay.
So you're exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, it just, I felt like there's a through line, you know, Lord of the Flies and The Lottery are celebrated as these great works of American fiction. Long right. Walk isn't much different than either one of them. Now, it came after, but I right. feel like it's up there with those two books. I feel like it shares a lot in common with those two books. So that's just, I think that's pretty impressive too. You know, another thing I'm going to say, like you just said something I think is really interesting. And we can touch on this more as we, you know, go into part two, but your idea, I never heard you say it this way, I don't think King started as a horror writer, and he certainly isn't ending as one. That's a really interesting, kind of a provocative take that we can unpack. But
yeah.
What it did make me do, though, is think about his first published novel. You know, because when you said that, I said, well, sure, he's writing horror novels. That's how he got famous, right? But then you look at Carrie, and you're like, is that a horror novel? I don't know, but in a way it is, in the sense of you said that I was using the word anxiety a lot. Well, there's a ton of anxiety baked into that book. It happens to be a female.
Sure. Yeah.
But you know, that's the kind of horror that your comment made me realize that I don't know if that's, he's sort of right in a way. His early books are more like, they start out being just like full of anxieties that kind of like become monsters almost. Mm-hmm. You know, and then he kind of moves on to literal monsters at some point. But
right.
what you said is
right.
really interesting. Is that kind of where you're going with that? Like, you feel like in the beginning that he was just maybe more focused on human anxieties versus, like, actual, like, goblins and ghouls and things like that? And
I don't know. We'll have to unpack that a little, because I don't know if I was thinking so much as, you know, the psychology of it, like the anxiety and the psychology.
Yeah.
But it just seems like his early, like if you take these Bachman books, and I thought about this going in, I was like, man, some people are going to be like, well, you guys screwed up your own premise because you didn't even pick like an actual Stephen King book for then. But these were the books he was writing before he was Stephen King, you know?
Absolutely. This is definitely King.
Yeah. And also these, if you look at the Bachman books, they're not horror books. They're like rage about the school shooting. You know, that is a prescient book and something that was happening, but that's like a very plausible act of violence. There's no goblin or monster there. The guy shooting the people is the monster. Then you have this dystopian, you know, futuristic, you know, kind of dark tale, The Long Walk. Then you have the Lorax type of tale, and you have The Running Man, which is kind of almost sci-fi thriller. So, you know, and I would argue that Carrie probably is a horror novel, you know, but you could definitely argue maybe not, you know, and then he did get famous for, you know, Salem's Lot was next, and The Vampires, and then he just became kind of the master of horror. But he said himself that he didn't really set out to be the king of horror. You know, he was just writing stories. And then if you want to get really deep into it, you go back into like his past and, you know, abandonment, you know, because he didn't have a father and all that stuff, which you can talk about maybe at some later point. But, you know, well, like where all this was coming from, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You could go two ways on this question. Like, all the books we're talking about seem pretty horrific to me. It feels like the distinction mm-hmm. you could make is like, yes, he's a horror writer, but the most compelling or the most frightening horrors are not supernatural horrors. They're like human.
Yeah,
horrors.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So
yeah.
It's like, I think at some point the supernatural comes in, you know, but maybe before that. Anyway, this is sort of straw splitting, but what we're saying,
right?
I think the point you're making, and it's a really interesting one, is that he kind of began. I don't know how to say this exactly, like just exploring the horror of human life, you know, the ways that
right.
can be horrific to each other,
right? The horrific possibilities of. You know,
growing up, like, chance to say this. I don't know if I've ever said this to you. I always thought one of the weirdest little bits about King, one of the most interesting things about King, is that his first novel is basically about kind of like the horrors of a young girl going through menstruation.
right.
Like, that's how he started. Like, and you know, the famous anecdote or story. I don't think it's a story. I think it's actually true. That he wrote a lot of this book and threw it away, and his wife pulled it out of the garbage can.
Yeah, that is a true story. Yeah.
Thought it was really good stuff. But take a step. Like, why was he writing about that? You know, like,
well, that's easy to discern in a way, though, because he was a high school, you know, English teacher. You know, like so he's observing like teens and. You know, young people, you know.
Yeah, okay, but he's not I mean specifically from the point of view of like a mixed up girl who's going through puberty.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he, you know, maybe he thought I have no business. Like, he thought it was shit. Pardon my French, so he threw it away. And it was the woman in the house who picked and said, no, this is not shit. And then he decided, you know, he could run with it, which is interesting too, but.
Well, I guess what I'm, yeah, no, that's true. And I think it's just interesting because a book like The Long Walk feels like it taps into male, maybe a specific form of it, but like male anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Carrie yeah. taps into like female anxiety, but it's like a lot in a way. And they both deal with like your peers and how they look at you and how they may make you feel and, you know, but they're, you know, these are sort of real. He's dealing with real life, quote unquote, horrors. And then as he goes along, you know, in his career, I guess Salem's Lot, which is still fairly early on, Salem's Lot is like, you know, kind of makes a leap to supernatural with like vampires, you know. And that was like his second or third book. So, you know, and we know he was reading about monsters and aliens and all kinds of stuff as a kid.
So, right.
Yeah. It wasn't far, but it is interesting to think. Yeah, I didn't really think of it before, but like in some ways, the novel Carrie, some of these early works like The Long Walk, you know, are kind of dealing with the same types of issues, just for looking at it from different perspectives. But anyway.
Well, should we touch on the end of the book?
Yeah. I was going to say, like, let's see, you know, we're talking pretty good. Time about it, but and we could keep going on. I think we're both you know, when we get to part two, hopefully we'll make some more, you know, do some more contrasting and connections. Not, I don't know that there are that many connections between The Long Walk and Fairy Tale, although world building is definitely one of them, in my opinion. I think we'll talk about, they have very different feels, in my opinion. Like
the yeah,
writing
in yeah.
2022 writing Fairy Tale. Boy, I'll just say now, like that's a much warmer book than what
mm-hmm.
did The Long Walk.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I think I was very surprised at The Long Walk. Like I didn't know, I'd read some earlier King books, but the early King books that I'd read, and I know you've said this before too, they're kind of nasty, you know, they're kind of mean and nasty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This book didn't strike me that way at all. This book was much more emotional, kind of, like I said, sad and wistful. So I was sort of surprised by that. I was surprised at the sophistication of the world building. I was surprised at the subtle political elements. And I will use the word subtle there in that case, because it doesn't hit you over the head, but it's definitely there.
Yeah. Yeah.
In general, I this is one of the better Stephen King books I've personally read, and that's saying a lot for the fact that he was 18. I think we're both pretty positive on it.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say just overall about the book, or you like? I think it's pretty clear that we both liked it quite a bit.
Well,
you liked it a little less. So like let's just touch on that briefly, and then yeah, let's talk a little bit about the end.
Okay. Yeah. I think, well, you know, so as we're discussing it and you bringing up a lot of good points, it's helping me appreciate the book more, which happens, you know, as you live with it for a while. I only finished it 2 days ago.
Yeah.
I thought it was just slow for a lot of the book. I did find myself wanting it to move quicker, you know, through much of the read. However, when I got into kind of the last 20 or 30 pages, it did start to kind of get to me a little bit more, you know. And then some of the, you know, those sentences I read before, and some of the, you know, some of the lapses, I think they're funny, but sometimes they're kind of annoying too. Like, you know, well, I don't, you know, you can take your opinion and shove it straight up the brown lane at the bottom of my, you know, like, it's funny, but it's like, you know, you're also kind of grown a little bit and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's true.
But there was a lot of good stuff going on, and sometimes that feels like it can take away from it. Like when you go from They Breasted the Hill to talking about boobs, you know, there's a part of me, you know, I mean, I am a 14-year-old boy at heart, but, you know, so I get it.
Yeah.
I know, but there's a part of you that's just like, okay, well,
yeah,
I'm not sure you needed that, but
yeah. Really? Yeah.
It was mostly about pacing though. I wanted it to move quicker in the early going, even though I appreciated that it dropped you in and, you know, so
yeah, I'm not
but
sure,
yeah, but
I'm not sure this book needed to be 400 pages anymore than I'm sure that Fairy Tale needed to be 600. Let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you said something earlier about the connection. I pointed this out to you. It's kind of funny that towards the end, it's like towards the climax of, the last 10 pages or so of, The Long Walk. It's just interesting because we certainly didn't plan this. One of the guys, you know, in order to deal with the pain and the tension and stuff like that, starts telling a story, and it's like once upon a time, and then the other guy says, like, we don't need a fairy tale. And the guy's like, well, fairy tale is what you're getting. And, you know, because those are the best stories or something like that. And the fairy tale, the novel, sort of trundles a lot in the concept of a fairy tale, which we'll get into.
Yeah,
so that was just an interesting bookend, because we certainly didn't plan that, like, not in any way. But, yeah, there was a couple things I wanted to say about the end. I could do them very quickly, but since you're leading this, do you want to take the lead of talking about the end of the book, or?
Well, I'll just set it up real quick. As we've been saying, and I agree with you, by the way, the pace lags here and there, but what kind of keeps you going is you want to know, obviously, who's going to win. Who's going to be there at the very end. But eventually you get there, and you know, different walkers sort of peel off, and you may have to help me a little bit with my memory here, but it ends up being, you know, spoiler alert, but it ends up being, you know, the main character walking with one other guy.
Right.
By the way, the last guy who ends up being the last survivor along with Garrity was a bit of a surprise to me. I kind of like what he did there too, because that guy was like in the background for a lot of the book. And I thought that was sort of interesting. But anyway.
You remember who it was?
I think it was this guy, was it Stebbins?
I don't think Stebbins was the second last guy, because Stebbins is a character that I was going to mention. I could be wrong.
Okay.
But it was somebody that you didn't necessarily expect would still be there.
I know it was somebody who was in the background for a lot of the book, just kind of here and there, but eventually emerges as one of the main sort of forces of the book. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But anyway.
Yeah.
They get to the end. You're going to have to help me because, like, I don't, you've finished it more recently. I know eventually we're left with only Garrity, and he's finishing the walk. But number one, instead of stopping the walk, he continues on. And in fact, I think he starts to run.
Right.
And then the second thing that emerges is that there's some kind of dark figure.
Right.
That he sees, and he is following, I think. It's like he sees a dark figure and he's going after it. And you have no idea what this dark figure is.
Right.
And I still don't. Like, I think,
right.
I think the ending, it has this very enigmatic ending that is entirely left in the hands of the reader to interpret. Right?
Correct.
Yeah. That to me is like, that's the big thing about the ending. It just has this very open-ended ending. And I really, if you're going to come tell me a theory you have about the ending, I'd love to hear it, because I'm really not sure what happened at the end.
Well, I know exactly who that guy is. It's the dark, you know, dude that's in the stand. No, I'm just kidding.
I think there are people like who think that.
Yeah, like the walking dude is that a big guy in the stand.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. It's also in that great Anthrax song, you know, I'm the walking dude. Anyway, nobody will catch that reference. So well, go like me.
You said, but you like, you just said we're 14 year olds at heart, and there it is.
But I have three things I wanted to say about the end, and you basically got it.
Before you do.
Oh yeah.
I want to point out that, I know that there are people, and we can talk about this later, but people try to make connections between King books all the time. I know there are people who are trying to make connections between Fairy Tale and like the universe of the Dark Tower.
No. Right. Which
I don't know how that
he
works.
Said he, works. He didn't want it to be there. He doesn't want people to find that connection.
Yeah. You know? So like, I guess my point is that I'm sure that there's endless speculation that this dark figure may be somebody else from another King book.
Right, 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 right. Totally. Anyway,
what are your thoughts or ideas about the ending?
Well, I can say them fairly quickly. So there's I might be wrong, like I said. I don't believe the character Stebbins was the second last guy. Could be wrong. But he was a guy that was hanging in the back. And he was kind of this sinister figure that never had anything good to say. And everybody was kind of afraid of the whole time. And he doesn't win. I was a little disappointed with what King did, the young King did with that character. I thought he was going to really be this like unhinged villain guy that was going to do something insane at the end. The twist on him turned out to be that he was the son of the major, like the guy who ran the people that shot you when you're the, I found that a little disappointing. You know, I thought he was going to do more. He basically reveals that, everybody gasps, and then he gets shot, you know? So, you know, I didn't love that part of it. I did really like the enigmatic ending. I have no idea who that dark figure was. And the one thing that you may not remember is that the ending wraps up very quickly. Garrity is the guy. Of course, you weren't sure if the main character was going to win or not. You know, you kind of wanted him to, but he ended up being the guy. Paid a heavy price. He crosses the finish line and the major is there waiting for him. And he starts giving him this like official greeting. You know, congratulations, you know, you are the winner, you know, and the guy who's crossing the finish line, Garrity, is like looking past him. And then the major says something to the effect of like, what are you even looking at? You know, like, you won the race, it's over. But he sees this dark figure, mysterious dark figure further down the road, which is, I think, is like significant, like beyond the finish line. And then he does some kind of like hand gesture, not the figure, Garrity. He starts like reaching towards the figure or like lifts his arms, and the major is baffled. And that's the way that the book ends, which I think is kind of mysterious. And I really like that. And before I let you react, the last thing I want to say is this may seem like cheap. I love this. I love little things like this. Again, 18 years old, but I just love this. Is to me is like a writerly thing. Some people may consider it a cheap shot, but the fact that this book called The Long Walk About a Long Walk ends on the word run, I thought was really cool. You know, just from a writerly technique, I thought it was smart to end The Long Walk with the word run. You know, it may be a small thing, but I found that satisfying. I was like, oh man, you know, like it gives you this feeling that there's like between that and the dark figure that there's like even crazier shit down the road. You're not going to get it, but you can sure imagine it if you want to.
Yeah.
So those are the things I wanted to say.
Miles to go before I sleep.
Right, right. You're like, oh crap. You know, like an end is as a beginning almost. You know, what does he start running for? And how can he run? You know,
how can he run? Number one, you know, and that's another thing, you know, throughout the book, it's like, I've tried to go on longer walks in mornings and stuff like that. Once you get past like 10 miles, you know, you feel it, at least at my age.
Oh,
know,
sure. Like, yeah.
You know, 10 miles is a pretty long walk. Well, these guys are going like, what, you know, 50, 60 miles a day. You know, it's like,
it's a little bit hard to believe, but
it's a little hard to believe. But, the ending, I don't have this master stroke about the ending. It's very mysterious. I mean, you could, you know, one obvious sort of interpretation is like, that's like a death figure, basically, you know, mm-hmm. like leading mm-hmm. him towards the ultimate end that we all have, that we're all walking towards, you know. But a little bit, you know, some of those last images, if you sort of tie this back to, you know, anxiety, either conscious or subconscious about, you know, being drafted, about the Vietnam War, about, you know, young men dying, you know, going overseas and then dying sometime in the future. It could represent something like that. Like, you know, like you keep going forward, and eventually, you know, a lot of people went overseas and went to their deaths, you know, a lot of young guys. So, it, you know, there's feels like there might be something of that in there.
Other could be that, his dad, you know, it's implied, just like Stephen King, that his dad left him at an early age.
Right.
You know, there's who knows?
Thing, yeah. There's a whole thing with his dad. Like, this is what I mean. There's some subtle, very subtle touches. Like, there's his dad became part of these like squads that they talk about. And you're never sure if he was like forcefully, you know, taken to become part of the squad or,
right,
you know, volunteered, but he never came back. So, like, you know, yeah, it could be his dad. It could be, you know, whatever he's chasing after, you know, and the fact that he starts running after it is interesting. It's just really open. But again, just in terms of, you know, we'll wrap it up here because we've been saying it a lot. There are just kind of layers of this book and just more sophistication than I would have expected from an 18-year-old Stephen King who, you know, gave us, you know, really kind of silly and ridiculous stuff, you know, later on in his career. There are innumerable examples, you know, of just like ridiculous or stupid or, you know, the Mangler, like,
or
the short story about the little green army man who, like, you know, attack you, kill you, or the, you know, I mean, you've said it many times before, at least to me, like, there's no concept that's too stupid for him to take on at some point, you know.
Or like the short story, famous short story, Survivor type, where the guy crashes on an island and then he just starts eating himself to survive. You're like, you know, what?
Yeah, or just like the story with the like scary monkey. You know?
Yeah,
like with the, you know, crashing the cymbals or whatever. I mean, it's like, there's a lot of stupid stuff in quotes, you know, in his body of work. This, totally. this story is not stupid though. And it's, I think it's kind of, it's too long. It lags in places, but it does carry an emotional punch that I was surprised at, you know? So,
yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. It's definitely more sophisticated, to use your word, than you would have expected from a very young, you know, writer.
Yeah. So that was a really interesting discovery for me. So that's the then part. And in our next episode, part two of this episode, episode 61, we're going to fast forward about 50 years, literally, and look at a recent novel that he wrote called Fairy Tale, which is a totally different vibe. And then we're going to talk some more about King and ask Jude some sort of fanboy questions about, you know, his experience reading Stephen King and, you know, his opinions of Stephen King. And we'll kind of dive into some more King material that way. But that's the plan for part two. So we don't need to tease anything because part two, we're hoping, will come out relatively soon. If you enjoy this discussion of Stephen King, then there's a whole part two for you to look forward to. I think that's about it. Jude, unless you have anything else you want to say.
No, I just want to say all this was your idea. This has been super fun. This first part of the episode did not disappoint. And I'm really looking forward to the second part. But, yeah, no, this has been great. And let's keep it going.
Yeah. Stephen King is always a lot of fun. That's the other thing. You know, he's just fun.
He's just very fun, you know. Yeah.
Like you were saying in the beginning, it's just, you know, there's a lot to be said for Obama or whoever wrote it said, to just bring pleasure to so many people for so long is really a staggering achievement in and of itself. So
I absolutely agree with that. That's a good note to end on. Like, just that, you know, he can be very proud of having done that. You know, he's brought a lot of joy to readers.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Please join us for part two. Jude, I know you're going to be there, and we'll talk to you on the next round of the Book Exchange podcast. Take it easy, everybody.
Thank you all for listening. See you later.